A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. anovelpodcast@gmail.com or @anovelpodcast. Look forward to hearing from you. Due to the wealth of topics that the novels in today's episode present, this episode has been split into two parts. You are now listening to part one. Part two will be released on the 15th of February, 2017. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined by Bill, Jared, Dawn, and Bailey. And today, we're discussing the fifth and final book from the Chronicles of Prydain series, The High King, as well as the collection of short stories, The Foundling. The High King was published in 1968 and concludes the story from the previous four books, and The Foundling, a collection of short stories, expanded the universe and gives us some backstory to the character, which was published in 1973. Be aware, unlike the last two episodes in this series, there will be spoilers in this episode. If you have not yet read these books, I highly encourage you to go out and read them before listening to our discussion. So, Jared, you've volunteered to go ahead and kick us off on the story. So, Jared, why don't you give us a start with a plot synopsis there?
Sure. So The High King starts right off where Terran Wanderer left off. Terran and Gurgi are heading home from their wanderings. And along the way, they receive word that Ilonwi has returned to Cair Dalvin. And with that very exciting news, they hurry back as quick as they can, excited to be reunited with her. And they find that along with Ilonwi, Rune, who became king since last we saw him in the Castle of Lyr, and also Glu, the former giant, journeyed with Ilonwi from Mona. During this meeting of sorts, Fluterflam bursts in, carrying a wounded Gwydion, and he informs everybody that the sword Durnwin was stolen by Aran. And it is at this point that we learn of Aran's ability to shapeshift, as he came to Gwydion and Fluter in the guise of Terran. Terran and Dalvin nurse Gwydion back to life, and he informs them that he must journey to Anuvin in an effort to reclaim Durnwin. He agrees to allow the companions to go with him as far as Cair Kadarn, which is the stronghold of King Smoit. Along the way, the companions become separated as Rune, Ilonwi, Fluter, and Glu return to Rune's ship to inform the captain of the change in plans. When Gwydion, Terran, Kahl, and Gurgi reach Cair Kadarn, they find that Smoit has been captured by Mag, who we also have not seen since the end of the Castle of Lyr, and they are locked up with Smoit in a spare larder. When Fluter, Ilonwi, and Rune finally reach the castle, Ilonwi recognizes that something is amiss, and they find out what has happened. They stumble upon, or I guess Gwistle of the Fair Folk stumbles upon them, and they squeeze him till they get agreement that he's going to help them with their rescue mission. And this is where the first major battle of the book takes place.
I thought it was also a very interesting Gwistle's return, the way he's still incredibly reluctant and yet still pivotal in the taking, or I should say the rescue of their companions.
Yes. Well, and he's pivotal in what happens after the battle, because as the companions are freed, they learn from Gwistle what's been going on at Anuvin, that Aran has been gathering his armies. For an attack on the Sons of Dawn in what will shape up to be the final battle for Prydain. So at that point, Gwydion abandons his quest to regain Durnwin and asks each of the companions to split up and gather together everyone that will fight with the Sons of Dawn in this battle. Terran is sent as a war leader to the Free Comets to gather those that he met during his wanderings in the fourth book, Terran Wanderer. And at that point, the armies of Prydain are assembled, and they rejoin at Cair Dathil, which is where the final battle begins And that's the stronghold of the Sons of Dawn, Gwydion's home.
Mm-hmm. So going into Cair Dathil, not knowing, or for your first time reading this book, going into Cair Dathil, you know, what were you guys expecting? I really had no idea what to expect at this. It almost felt like it was moving straight into the final scene where it was just going to be a battle. What were you guys anticipating going into that scene and finally getting the armies all put together?
That's a great question. For me, I don't really remember. I was young enough the first time I read it. I think I was just enjoying every word, but I don't know what other responses are.
Mm-hmm. I remember maybe expecting to see a lot more a lot more of the focus to be on war preparations and mm-hmm. strategies mm-hmm. and battle plans. And I remember being a little surprised that they spent so much time talking about all that Cair Dathil was protecting, like the Hall of Lore and all that knowledge and history. And
yeah.
And that whole chapter with Taliesin, the chief bard.
And it's that scene, speaking of Taliesin, that's where he meets with Fluta, and Taliesin says to Fluta, now correct me if I've got the wrong scene here, but he says to him, I think I did you a bad turn by giving you that harp. And Fluta says, no, absolutely, I really love this thing.
Yep.
And it doesn't break any strings when he says it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it doesn't break either when he says how annoyed he is with it, but it definitely is possible to feel both.
I was just remembering, I don't remember, similar to Jared, I was so young when I read it, I don't really remember what I was anticipating, but was there anyone else really shocked by what we discover about Pryderi and the...
Oh, yeah.
The change, the betrayal. It kind of mirrored, I think, Morgant from the second book.
Yes.
So it didn't, you know, it's not completely new, but, you know, in an even broader scope, that was a surprise.
Yeah, it was such a low blow, and it was so unexpected. That coupled with the whole reason they were stalling, Pryderi's army was stalling, was so the Cauldron Board can come and mm-hmm. really just destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
It really just put a complete left turn, you know, on the whole series. You know, you're kind of expecting this big battle. You don't know who's going to win, who's going to lose, but you didn't really expect, you know, basically complete annihilation. Everybody's mm-hmm. scattered, and it's probably the low point of a lot of the characters in the series, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I went into it not expecting a betrayal of that sort, almost as if it reminded me quite a bit of The Lord of the Rings
mm-hmm.
and the wizards. I'll just say that, what happens with the wizards. I was almost expecting him to go a different route.
Yeah.
But you're right. It really takes you to that focal point where now everything is completely changed. And then, yeah. of course...
Especially they kept saying how we've very little chance of winning, but at least we've got Pryderi on our mm-hmm. side. That just gives us a fighting chance. And then...
Mm-hmm.
No.
Nope.
and then you have Gwydion, you know, finally gathering what forces remain, gathering them together and saying to him, this is what we have to do. We need to march. And forgive me for glossing over specifics, but we're going to take our force and we're going to march directly towards Aron, and we're going to take him out right now. Mm-hmm. And Taran, I need you to take your forces and just make sure that the Cauldronborn don't get to us in time. And and he says, well, how should I reach you? Taran says, how should I reach you if I were to fail? And he's just, if you fail, it's over.
Over.
Yep.
And this brings about the heaviest theme that I see recurring in the book, or I should say the second heaviest, is this book ending. Mm-hmm. In the first book, you have Taran chasing after an army, trying to slow them down, trying to get ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in the final book, and he's just got the exact same quest. But you've seen how he tackles it and how much he's grown mm-hmm. between the first and then this journey that he has to go on. To me, it bookends, and it really is one of the reasons why I like this book quite so much.
Mm. That's a fascinating parallel I hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, I hadn't either. And it's interesting because it's a mirror of itself, because in the first book, it really doesn't matter whether he's successful or not.
That's a good point.
It's absolutely no bearing on the outcome. And in this book, it's crucial, you know, whether mm-hmm. he's successful becomes the turning point.
I think that's actually a very good theme throughout the entire book of The High King, is that you thought that the choices and the stakes for all the characters were high before, and that the sacrifices they had to make were high before. Boyd Alexander just keeps upping it and upping it and upping it, even continuously through The High King itself.
Mm-hmm. It's heartbreak after roadblock after stopping point.
It's also interesting how both in the first and the fifth book, how both times he doesn't really quite succeed in the mission he's given, but he mm-hmm. also kind of does inadvertently. Like in the first book, along the way of trying to do what he's trying to do, he mm-hmm. just comes across Henwen and takes her out of the fair folk realm. And mm-hmm. because of that, she eventually finds Gwydion, and he's able to defeat the Horned King. And in this one, he isn't quite able to stop the Cauldronborn, at least not how he plans to, but he is able to find mm-hmm. the sword Durnwin and stop that way.
Exactly.
Too, how Durnwin itself becomes, there's a mirror there as well, because mm-hmm. its discovery in the first book, which was already important, suddenly becomes actually one of the most important things to happen.
Yes.
So when Tarin sets out on his journey to thwart the Cauldronborn, to just prevent them from getting to Anuvin before Gwydion is able to win that battle, as he sets out, what are the things that he's encountering along the way?
I found it interesting that, or not even interesting, but one thing that I especially enjoyed about that segment of the novel was his gathering of troops and all of the people he had met during his wanderings in the previous novel, and how that loyalty they had for him remained, and he had no trouble at all gathering men to fight his cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that bit.
Yeah, people really flocked to him. I mean, Lonio shows up out of nowhere, and of course I'm blanking on their names, but is it the people of Comet Marin who he saved from Dorath in the previous book?
It was Comet Esav that he saved.
Esav, you're right.
And Comet Marin that was burned.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That symbol, that piece of pottery that he pulls from the wreckage of Anlaw's house,
mm-hmm.
as I'm not sure the literary term that you use for that kind of a thing that someone holds on, like a talisman of some kind.
No, talisman was actually the word that Lloyd used.
But that, I mean, that you could tell that what happened to Anlaw really hit Tarin hard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the same way as in Tarn Wanderer.
Craddock?
Yes, thank you.
Oh,
Craddock.
Yes.
Probably the same way, probably more so for Craddock, because Tarin actually said, quote, "You are my father, I stay," mm-hmm. unquote. Another thing I wanted to make known was when Tarin's talking with Lasser, the shepherd boy,
mm-hmm.
but Tarin seeing Lasser himself years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he's seeing all of Lasser's willingness to go out there and thinking that heroism is walking around in shining armor all the time.
Yeah.
And Tarin now knows what he knows because of his experience and perspective that he's gained by living life as mm-hmm. Becoming a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting that he never actually had maybe like a one-on-one talk with Lasser, maybe the same way that Gwydion had with Tarin.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, one of the things that I find the most interesting about this book, because this is the only book that it happens in, is that we have at least two chapters, I think it's only two, that are written from a different point of view.
Yeah.
Yes.
Than Tarin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's three chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a three. Oh, yes, that's right. It is three because, okay, we have the crow, and then there's the Elanwë one, and then is the third one of the wolves? Or
it's Dolphin
and Prederi.
Yeah.
It's Medwin sending out his animals.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Medwin. Forgot.
Well, that is through Kaw's perspective.
That's through Kaw's perspective, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm not quite sure what I think of that. I'm wondering what other people's opinions. It's almost that I think of the weaving metaphor that he's always bringing back.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly all these separate threads are coming together. and you know, you're finding out what's going on with these other characters for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Something more than just Taryn's perspective is treated as crucial to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, I was actually really really excited actually the first time I got through the High King, and I all of a sudden we're following Ilanwe for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty refreshing. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's kind of like the novel of her growing, of her education that was never written.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like that.
Yeah.
Really good. Well, or we might be able to extrapolate what the other one might have been like.
I really loved seeing the Dalvin chapter. That was one of my favorite chapters.
Mine as well.
Mine too.
Series. He just, it's great. You know, all you see him as is a feeble old man. And this time, you know, you actually get to see him display his power and kind of kick some tail. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's interesting the way that, you know, when Pryderi shows up, and of course Dalvin's able to make all his minions just scamper away, eventually it comes to be told that Pryderi knows the weakness, that Dalvin can't kill. Now, I mean, I'm kind of curious as to what he means by that. Is it that his powers just won't kill anybody, or is he bound by some kind of oath? Was there a deeper significance there in some kind of older lore?
It seemed to me it was some sort of, like, deeper kind of, it would go against the laws of nature or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just something that can't happen, that the physical laws of the universe won't permit it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my interpretation.
Some kind
as well.
Of deep magic.
Mm.
Yeah, I felt the same way, because then in the end, those same laws made it so that he didn't have to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good one.
Yeah, but
my interpretation. Sorry.
Go ahead, please. Go
my
ahead.
My interpretation of Dalvin's inability to kill was more of a curse.
Mm-hmm.
That his magic or his abilities, they had all of these perks,
mm-hmm.
but the one thing he could not do is kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I also felt like it was something that Dalvin, as a person, it was against his morals, and it was something he physically could not bring himself to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was one of the drawbacks of the gift he got from the three witches, that was that if he killed, perhaps he would be killed himself, mm-hmm. or some natural disaster would occur, like some huge sort of circumstance. That's the way I always interpreted it.
Mm. Yeah, as if the universe had to write itself or rebalance.
Yes.
We see a similar theme across literature in the stories of Batman. Batman has a code of ethics that he will not kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's one possible explanation, that, like Bailey was saying, it could be his moral,
mm-hmm.
his moral code, that regardless of what else happens, he has made that commitment that he never will kill anybody.
I felt like it was some sort of natural balance, like that somebody's being imbued with so much power is balanced out by no killing.
Mm. Yeah, and if we're going to bring superheroes into the mix, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Now, that brings us then to, you know, as Taryn is finally setting out, and he's battling against the Cauldred Morn, and he has some victories and some defeats, and he's slowed them down, but he's running into issues as he goes. Then eventually he does become separated from Ilanwe and Gurgi, and he's very distraught, but he sticks with his mission, and he spares as much time as he can searching for them, but he just doesn't find them. And that's when he's led into an opportunity. He meets up with Dolly. And he's led into an opportunity. He said, Dolly says we could go through the mines of Moria. and he says, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do.
Off the bone.
And that's when we get to the scene with Ilanwe and her perspective chapter. And Dawn, I'm sure you have some interesting opinions about that. I'd love to hear them.
Well, I have to say, as a teenager reading the book, yes, I was very thrilled to actually get a chapter from her perspective. of course, as we know, it's an extremely intense chapter and disturbing
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways. Alexander was so very conscious of the youth of his audience that, you know, that the stories are very, you know, the romance that we get is very innocent. Mm-hmm. And so then to run into a chapter where she's nearly assaulted in the way that it's clear that her assailant is intending, mm-hmm. was really shocking to me, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, it increases the amount of danger. It was just, I've even heard people complain about it from like a feminism perspective that, oh, of course, you know, he had to use this trope. But unfortunately, it's a very realistic one. And so that he would put this sort of these kinds of stakes on her, to me, it's, again, I always come back to this. It's a respectfulness for his audience and what they can handle that. Yes, you know, we are going to deal with serious themes here. He also handles it so delicately that if you're young enough, you don't really even understand what exactly is going on.
Yeah, you know she's in trouble, but you don't know exactly how much.
Right, but you don't really know the nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very touching to me that she immediately, you know, defends herself with by, you know, threatening him with Taryn's wrath. I'm like, okay, that she already, you know, considers herself bound to him, even though there's been nothing official, you know, stated at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how extremely satisfying it is when, you know, he gets his throat ripped out by the wolves. I can't even describe.
Yes.
So it's, you know, in a way it feels a little contrived. You know, you have the deus ex machina of the animals arriving at exactly the right moment. On the other hand, I mean, fantasy literature is full of those types of moments. So
mm-hmm.
you can't really blame him. And it works very well, I think, just for really cementing how serious this whole book is. Not that it wasn't serious before, but he's really throwing every possible type of trauma, you know, in one book. We have death, we have, you know, despair, we have loss, you know, losing battles, and now we have the near assault of the heroine.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really not pulling any punches. Mm-hmm. He's everything on the line in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have her then overcome this and you know, follow the wolves out, and then the scene where she's using the bauble to light the way and, you know, illuminate. I've always thought of her character as being there, and there's a word for this somewhere, and I don't remember what it is, but a light bringer. She's, you know, there's
light bringer.
That's a figurative term in a lot of literature, but her, it's literal. She literally carries a light around. And in this particular scene, you have the culmination of what that does. She literally mm-hmm. saves the nation in this particular part by illuminating what's going on. And it's, the bauble kind of seems to have this, this illuminating effect on whatever, you know, her emotions mm-hmm. of the moment. And in that moment, to see her so, invested in, you know, not only the outcome of the battle, but in the fate of her friends, it's just very, very moving to me. I really, really love that scene, and I can picture it so vividly. And then to know, you know, I picture it also from, you know, from the other side where they're all on the bottom and they see this light and suddenly realize that, oh, she's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And complete elation that must overtake them all at that moment,
mm-hmm.
even regardless of everything else that's going on.
So. In previous episodes, the podcasters have talked about how groundbreaking Ai Lanhui was as a heroine in the 1960s in fantasy, and I totally agree with that. I also want to point out that she actually puts on armor in this book
mm-hmm.
and wears it during most of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And
love that.
I think of artistic depictions of Joan of Arc and mm-hmm. et cetera,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, female jousters I've met at the Renaissance Festival. And that's actually a really, when you think about what would make a great heroine, is even from the man's perspective, that's very attractive.
Hmm.
You know, it's interesting because I think in our modern times, the girl with sword thing has kind of, it's become such a trope, it's become a little cliche. You know, there's been an upswing of films and books in which the heroine is considered, it seems like the only reason they could think of for making her strong was, well, we'll just make her fight like the guys. And I think that kind of misses the point. You know, it takes more than a, as we know from Tyrion's whole story, it takes more than a sword in your hand to be a strong individual. Mm-hmm. And I like that, you know, from the very beginning, Elon was carrying a sword around. He was using this trope before it was a trope. Yet with her, it doesn't feel forced. I mean, in the first book, she's carrying a sword around she can't even use. Mm-hmm. And by the end, she's kind of, like Taryn, she's earned the right to be at his side and fighting in this skirmish just simply because of, you know, what they've accomplished mm-hmm. and who she is. So.
And her strong personality is what makes that chapter with Dorath so impactful. Also, Alexander in that chapter used the exact words, for the first time, she was deeply afraid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to have such a strong character, and then something's happening to her which causes that mm-hmm. fear, just makes it so much more impactful.
So you have Taryn, who's using Dolly's shortcut to try and head off the Cauldronborn, and it looks like they're going to make it just fine when you have
glue.
Yeah. Just being glue, completely...
That little mushroom face, too.
Unaware of what's going on, not paying any attention, flabby little nose, wanting his treasure, and he just ruins everything. Which, of course, turns the group around, and they say, well, this is not good, but we have to do something. And as they exit, they see the light, and that is, I believe, the first... And one thing we didn't mention in our synopsis in the beginning was, of course, the prophecies that Henwen made.
Yeah, is that the first?
I'm not sure if it is or not. It's the first one I'm thinking of tonight. I thought it was the first.
It's the first time Taryn has ever seen Henwen prophecy during his whole life.
Right.
Yeah, the first prophecy was, ask sooner mute stone and voiceless rock to speak.
I've got it here. I can read it.
Please do.
Yeah. Quenched will be Durnwin's flame, vanished its power. Night turned to noon, and rivers burn with frozen fire ere Durnwin be regained.
Mm-hmm. So here we have night turning to noon, and companions getting back together, and they set off on their way. So we've got glue kind of getting in the way.
The Gwythaints, then the army of Krogh comes and drives them off.
Of course.
And then they find Ochre.
Of course.
Wait, did we
see the frozen river?
Yes, the frozen fire.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's the next part of the prophecy.
They're coming out and they run right into some huntsmen.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's what the light is for.
Nice. And they're trying to figure out how they can eliminate them without having to eliminate them one by one in combat, because that just superpowers the rest of them.
Right.
And so Dolly figures out a way to wipe them all out in one swoop, and all they have to do is light a fire.
Set the river ablaze.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got the animals of the forest standing around, keeping the huntsmen at bay, while they go up, chop the river apart, light it on fire.
Got you right where we want you.
Might we backtrack a bit to discuss the involvement of the fair folk in all of this? What I recall, the fair folk were a bit reluctant to associate with humankind in general, much less their problems. But the fact that Iran was very close to taking power is something that would have affected them as well.
Mm-hmm. And because Tarn saved the fair folk from Morda in the previous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I believe Dolly says that King Idyllic speaks very highly of Taryn when Taryn's not actually there.
That's true. He does, by getting rid of Morda, he does. They owe him some loyalty.
So it is kind of a pulling out of all the stops. I mean, you've got Lonio and Lasser who probably have absolutely no interest in fighting, but they see Taryn and they say, well, yes, I'm going to get behind you. Yeah. Then you got Medwin who's saying, and here's another interesting bookend, is that you see Medwin in the first and fifth books only. Am I right?
Right.
Yeah. Correct.
So you got Medwin saying to all his animal guys, this is the time. They need us now. Go. And Brynek and Briavel, of course, play very important roles once again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fair folk even jump in and say, well, and then you got Gwystle coming back to help out at King Smoit's castle. So there, I mean, not only is Lloyd Alexander pulling out all the stops, but you see all the characters and all the different races and groups in the book who are also saying this really is it. This is coming to a head. Iran needs to be stopped now. Mm-hmm. And that's when they, you know, after leaving the destruction of the Huntsman, as they walk along, they see Gwythaints circling, and they go and they find Akran. Akran, who, on being told, no, you can't go get Iran, because she'd been at Kaer Dalvin, she just ups and leaves.
Yeah, she mm-hmm. just took off. Right. Took Actually, way at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And it was Akran who had said, and she's been saying this the whole time, says, Iran used to serve me. I taught him all his secrets. Mm-hmm. I can get him. I can take him back. And so she sets out, and now she's really in dire straits.
Right. Yeah, Akran
makes me wonder if she actually could have if she hadn't been killed.
That's an interesting.
Akran has a very interesting character arc, I guess, especially in book 5. Mm-hmm. If you stop and think about it, like, this is the evil queen who mm-hmm. who was usurped.
Yeah. And she never stops really just being in it for herself.
No.
Mm-hmm. You know, even at the end, everyone else is rallying mm-hmm. tellingly. Not necessarily behind Gwydion, but behind Taryn. And she is not. She's not really interested in mm-hmm. joining the cause. She just wants her revenge.
Right.
So while she does have some arc, she's still Akran. She's still, you know, yes. she's very much self-serving. I find her a fascinating character. And in some sense, you know, somewhat redeemed by the mm-hmm. end. That she's a very realistic character, and that she's really only motivated by a limited number of things.
So between Glue and Akran, and then later on, and I'm going to jump ahead now so I can just throw these three characters together and ask a question about them. Later on, Taryn's in trouble. He's all by himself, and he sees a Gwythaint coming right at him. He has nothing to do to help himself in this situation. And the Gwythaint comes down, and rather than attacking, the Gwythaint actually helps him. He picks him up and takes him someplace where he can be safe. And you realize that it's the same Gwythaint. Here's that bookend again. Here's the same Gwythaint from book one that Taryn insisted, this is a creature that's hurt. We need to take care of it. And everybody around him says, no, you're crazy. This thing only wants to kill you or report your movements to Iran. And he insists, no, we can take care of him. And he flies the coop, and everyone's thinking, I told you. But here we are, four books later, and it comes back, and he did a good turn, and he's rewarded for it. So you have the Gwythaint, you have the Akran and Glue, and you have these characters who all share similarities with the Gollum figure, where is he good, is he bad? Is he going to help you, is he going to hurt you? Is he just going to get in the way? And how important they are to the character. And it was... you know, I'm gonna help you out, and then in the end you're gonna help me back. How far back mm-hmm. does a character yeah. like that go? I mean, are there Shakespeare characters that were like this? Is there a one single term that we can use to describe this?
The Lion and the Mouse.
Yes.
Mm.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's as old as storytelling, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, I love the Gwythaint. Is very, I love that moment because in the first book, that's an extremely pivotal moment in Taryn's arc when mm-hmm. he refuses to kill it, because the Taryn at the beginning of the book would have killed it immediately right. without even.
Yeah.
And by the mm-hmm. time he gets to that point and actually shows mercy when everyone else is saying, no, we should kill this thing. That's an extremely powerful chapter. So then to have it come full circle, and again, we talked about this before, because Lloyd Alexander never threw away any characters. Everyone had a deeper purpose than originally appears.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's just it's a really beautiful moment. And I think even Gwydion at the end of the Book of Three even mentions, you know, that the Gwythaint, if Iran ever finds out what she's done, is going to be in real trouble. And then I believe in the High King, when the other Gwythaints realize what she's done, they immediately turn on her and
mm-hmm. kill her.
And it's heartbreaking.
I never saw that.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me that apparently she'd kept it pretty well hidden all that time. that she'd committed this act of mercy. And maybe she wasn't necessarily good so much as she just remembered him. She had some kind of an imprinting, you know, just on him and was to show him mercy where she may not have been anyone else.
Yes.
I think that the recurring theme of good and evil intertwined.
Mm.
I love that. I love that theme, and I think he nails it in this book because, I mean, the Gwythain's a perfect example. Ocran, you kind of your heart goes out to her at the end when she gets killed, but then Glue, what a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. I really thought about Glue a lot. If you were to put Glue into like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that works at the office, who would like him? Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to say he's a personification of a device that Lord Alexander frequently uses, where something terrible and awful and really unfortunate happens. It completely throws things off track. But in the end, it turns out it was very lucky. Just took a long time for that to become clear.
Right.
Yes.
Going the long way around, put them on the path that happened to be best.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Glue as a character, I was thinking about evil a lot and how there's some characters who are just outright evil,
mm-hmm.
which you know they are.
Yeah.
But then there's, I mean, kind of a loose definition of being evil is selfishness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't get any more selfish than Glue. I mean, he's just constantly whining and thinking about himself. And in that way, he's evil. And mm-hmm. when you think about it, he's a nice guy, but all the characteristics that he displays are just... You know, just so pathetic, and he's kind of whiny and selfish, and you know, he's just that person everyone loves to hate. I don't know. It was interesting.
On the other hand, I guess I'd like to point out that even Glue at one point says, right after he loses all the gems and the cave collapses, he says, "All of you guys are thinking about Cauldronborn, and this. Did it ever occur to you that I just lost a fortune?" More wealth than I've ever had.
Yeah,
and,
I think that ended
and he says that's just selfish. And so he's trapped in his own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it takes until almost the end of the book for him to even break out of that. Even just
and then the little scoundrel gets to go to the summer country.
But I think it's just like the Gwythain from book one, where you have someone or something that is going to put a little bit of good and a little bit of love your way. And Glue, it took layer after layer. They've been working on him for 2.5 books. I want to help you. I want to help you. I want to do right by you. But then finally, in the end, when Gurgi saves him from the fires, and even comes out and says, yes, Gurgi says, yes, he saved my life. Glue finally picks up and says, no, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Gurgi saved my life. I owe it all to him. And finally you get through to this, either if he's indifferent or if he's evil, you finally got through to him and actually made a difference. And that's almost the exact same thing that Taran did in book one with that Gwythain.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
And then Glue starts growing again. Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting that it's the most kind of humble member of their party who finally brings him a touch of humility.
Mm-hmm. So coming up, meeting Ocran, Ocran's able to say to them, you guys are heading in the right direction, but you need to follow me. I know the exact right way to go. And they would have never run into Ocran if Glue hadn't ruined their trip through the mines.
Right.
So they run into Ocran, and of course they're questioning, do we trust this person? I guess we really don't have a choice. But then they get separated, and it starts to snow, and the blizzard is intense, and a few of the companions are trapped with no shelter, and they begin
to freeze to death.
And pass out, and I'm sure somebody has a more eloquent way of saying it than I do. How does everybody feel about this scene?
It's the scene where... every reader begins to cry.
Yes.
Yeah.
And every reader loses it.
Yeah. And you can't see any way for them to get out of it.
Yeah. And not even Dolly is able to do anything about it.
It seems like that peak of the book, the lowest point where all hope seems to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Almost similar to the fall of Khyr Dothel, but in another way,
yes.
I think, because this affects our main characters directly and their lives directly. And we see Ailanui beginning to fall into delirium, and and everyone's passing out, dying in the snow. And it's so, Peter's sacrifice, really, that makes it even worse.
It's and, gallant, wonderful, heroic Flutter. I think it's very, there's a nice parallel here, because in almost every book, I'm trying to think, making sure, well, in at least three of the books, we have a main character having to sacrifice something very precious to save their friends, or at least, you know, finish the quest.
Yeah.
And so we have Taryn sacrificing, you know, giving up the brooch. We have Ailanui giving up all of her heritage and use of her powers. And now we have Flutter, you know, and he always makes a little light of the harp, and it becomes almost a character in and of itself. A very humorous one. And so I think it's almost, I know for me, it was almost shocking how much I was affected by this chapter, because you don't think of it as being, you think of it as being funny, like, oh, the harp is funny and Flutter's a funny character.
Yeah.
And then to get to this chapter and suddenly be hit with this pathos where, you know, the, and especially not just that he burns it, but that while it's burning, it plays all these.
Oh my gosh.
and the effect that it has on all of them. It's as though he's putting his own heart on the altar for them.
Yeah, and it's made even more poignant by that scene earlier with Taliesin, where he was given an opportunity to give up the harp and he chose not to.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he even has a last lie that he tells.
Yes.
And the
yes,
harp.
Yes, that was brilliant.
Fire. I love that.
And then after that, he keeps telling lies and looking over his shoulder, waiting to hear the twang.
And then he's able to keep that one harp string, the gift of the one unbreakable string.
The older I get, the more I realize just what an amazing writer Lloyd Alexander actually was. Just, and these books, they're considerably smaller in scale compared to a lot of the high fantasy we see. But in that small span of these novels, there's just so much material. It's so rich in a lot of different things that affect you.
Yeah, I've read all of Lord of the Rings. I've read all of A Song of Ice and Fire. I've read all of C.S. Lewis, and there are even scenes and little snippets from all of those that I find to be, you know, more grandiose and more poignant than anything I've read in Lloyd Alexander. But the thing about these five books is the way it is so, and I hesitate to use the word, but I can't think of a better one. It's so perfect. There's no lulls. There's no point where I go, well, that doesn't make any sense. Or there's no point where I hate getting through the Tom Bombadil scenes. There's nothing like that in Lloyd Alexander.
One reviewer who actually wrote a blog entry somewhere and then praised Don's artwork, he said that in these five books, not one sentence is wasted.
Yes. That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah.
So Fluta's self-sacrifice saves the companions. They're able to meet back up with the army, and they follow Akrin up into, and she's leading them straight into Mount Dragon. And Dolly is saying, you're crazy. That is our death. Do not follow her. But Taryn decides, yes, she knows the secret passages. That's the way we're going to go. And along the way, Taryn is separated, and that's when he is saved by the Gwythaint, who he had saved earlier. And he finds himself at the top of Mount Dragon, and he hears something. And the Cauldronborn are coming towards him.
The wind through the stone. The stone speaks.
Speaking stones. And so what happens at that point?
At that point, Taryn pushes a boulder over to topple some of the Cauldronborn. And then he's trying to find his next weapon as they're about to kill him. And he finds that underneath that boulder at the peak of Mount Dragon was hidden Durnwin. And so as his last resort, he picks it up and he doesn't even think, I don't think, he just pulls it out and stabs the first Cauldronborn that comes up to him right through the heart.
He realizes, and, oh, I can draw the sword now and not get shocked.
Well, he doesn't realize that until afterward.
He's desperate for some kind of weapon. He doesn't even recognize it as Durnwin when he first grabs it. He just has a sword and he
like you say, he stabs the Cauldronborn, and the way it's described, I wish I had it in front of me to quote it, but the scream that comes as a unified voice from all the Cauldronborn at the same time, powerful.
Yeah.
And then he realizes it's Durnwin, which is, to me, a huge, amazingly powerful bookend to the series. The first book, he wasn't ready. And then, of course, Bull Dungsrman's story, he grows, he learns, he matures, he finds it in the end. And just as it did with the Horned King, it is now the destruction of the Cauldronborn. But this time, Tarin is of noble worth and is able to draw the sword. Please.
Okay, so this is from the High King. Dazzled, the Cauldronborn dropped his sword and flung his hands to his face. Tarin leaped forward and with all his strength drove the blazing weapon deep into the warrior's heart. The Cauldronborn stumbled and fell, and from lips long mute burst a shriek that echoed and re-echoed from the Death Lord's stronghold, as though rising from a thousand tongues. Tarin staggered back. The Cauldronborn lay motionless.
That sentence still gives me chills. I just got chills. It's so descriptive. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
And the Cauldronborn, from the moment you meet them, they are described as mute, as voiceless.
Yeah, and that comes from legend.
And their death cry from Durnwin. I'm at a loss for words at how powerful that is.
My heart's racing thinking about it.
But of course, the fighting is not over. From Tarin's perspective, he's up here. They're coming. And of course, there's a scene before he even sees Durnwin. He says, you know, we made it. It looks like the battle is going all right. And then he sees coming around, must have come around a hill or something. Here comes the army of Cauldronborn. And of course, a couple of them come up to him. But now that the Cauldronborn are taken care of, there's still fighting going on. So he runs down to, the Warriors Hall. It had a name. What was the name of that hall?
The Hall of Warriors.
Hall of Warriors.
There you go.
And he tries to meet up with, Gwydion and the rest of the army, and what is going on when he gets down there?
He comes face to face with the Death Lord, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realize
Gwydion's form.
Mm-hmm. And it's the one time in the series that we see Uron speak, even though it's in the form of Gwydion.
Right.
And this is something that I didn't quite follow, and maybe somebody has a reason for this, but they're very specific in the beginning of the book about how his guise will be perfect, and no one will be able to tell the difference. And is it hubris on Aran's part, by saying words that he should know that Gwydion would never say? Mm. What is going on here? How is Tarin able to see through the guise?
I think it's the disguise in appearance is perfect, mm-hmm. but the actions could betray it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And Aran is a terrible actor.
Mm.
Yes. Yes. I can't imagine how somebody wouldn't want to seize power.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity arose. Right. It just doesn't occur to him that Tarin might say, no, I'm not interested in ruling Prydain.
Mm-hmm. And so when he sees through the guise, I love the description of him turning into a shadow and trailing around the corner.
Mm.
But then, of course, the companions meet back up, and that's when, you know, Akrin's gone missing. She runs out into the Hall of Warriors to try and find him.
This concludes part 1. Part 2 will be released on the 15th of February, 2017.